This is VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. For the next 60 minutes, I'll take you on a tour of some of the top news stories and features that made up our daily VOA Asia program. U.S. President Donald Trump declared Monday that he is very happy with the pace of ongoing negotiations with North Korea to end Pyongyang's nuclear weapons program. That rebuffed news accounts to the contrary. Trump said on Twitter a rocket has not been launched by North Korea in 9 months. Likewise, no nuclear test. Japan is happy. All of Asia is happy. He went on to say, but the fake news is saying without ever asking me, always anonymous sources, that I'm angry because it's not going fast enough. Wrong. Very happy. Several news outlets had reported that behind the scenes at the White House, Trump has voiced his displeasure with aides at the pace of talks and pushing North Korea to abandon its nuclear weapons program. I spoke about this with Bruce Klingner, senior research fellow at the Washington-based Heritage Foundation.
Well, regardless of whether the president is happy or not, there's no evidence that North Korea is denuclearizing. In fact, the available open-source satellite imagery, as well as leaks from the intelligence community, is that North Korea continues, if not also expanding, its production facilities for its missiles, its nuclear fissile material, as well as the reentry vehicles for the missiles that can threaten the United States and as well as our allies. There's really no evidence that North Korea is committing to denuclearize. And in fact, the very strong critical statements it made after Secretary of State Pompeo claimed progress during his meeting in Pyongyang shows that the two sides really remain very far apart, even on the definition of what denuclearization is.
Isn't this what had been predicted by many experts before the summit was held?
Very much so. In May, when a senior North Korean official publicly made a statement that basically reiterated longstanding North Korean policy, it was no surprise to Korea watchers, but it came as quite a surprise to the White House, which perceived it as a broken promise that Kim Jong-un was going back against the word he had given that he was willing to talk about denuclearization. But because Pyongyang defines denuclearization as global arms control and as a member of the nuclear club, they'll go down to zero when the rest of the members, including the United States, go down to zero nuclear weapons. That really was longstanding North Korean position. The Trump administration, however, had thought that Kim was willing to abandon his nuclear arsenal.
But apparently that is not the case. Why then do you think that both Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump agreed to such a summit meeting?
Well, the summit meeting served purposes for both leaders. For Kim Jong-un, it was a way of gaining legitimacy. It was a way of continuing to diffuse the previous U.S. administration talk about a preventative attack on the North. It enabled the North to sort of further divide the U.S. from its allies. And to undermine international support for the sanctions that were hurting the regime's finances. For President Trump, it was a way of claiming success. He saw that Kim would abandon his nuclear arsenal, in an easier way than is going to be the case. The resulting Singapore communique was very terse. It was weaker than previous agreements between North Korea and the outside world. Particularly the denuclearization section was weaker than the six-party talks joint statement of 13 years earlier. So, since then we've seen North Korea drag its feet, even on the seemingly already agreed upon low-hanging fruit of returning remains of U.S. servicemen killed during the Korean War, as well as reunions of Korean families separated since the end of the war, which South Korea was hoping to achieve. I think both sides actually have an interest in allowing the diplomacy to drag on. What we've seen the Trump administration doing is already abandoning maximum pressure. The president has said, there are already 300 North Korean entities that he's not sanctioning. That's equal to the number of sanctions that the United States government cumulatively sanctioned in the 8 years of the Obama administration, plus the first year and a half of the Trump administration. Also, we've seen Trump and Pompeo fall off of their earlier insistence on expeditiously implementing denuclearization. Now they're saying there's no rush, there's no time limit. So, in a way, with the lower pressure and abandoned timelines, the Trump administration has adopted the strategic patience policy of the Obama administration.
So in addition to tweets, what else do you think the U.S. president or the U.S. government, for that matter, can do to either save face or move forward in the future?
Well, they have to decide sort of which path they want to go down. They can agree to kind of lengthy, arduous, difficult negotiations with the North, trying to, you know, reach a viable diplomatic solution. They can adopt a maximum pressure that actually is maximum. They can stop pulling U.S. punches and enforcing its own laws against North Korean and Chinese entities that are violating U.S. law. Or the other options, is especially if they feel that the diplomatic track has actually failed, we may hear a return by some, including in the administration, to, you know, have a preventive military attack against the North. Or there may be a sort of a realization that it's just too difficult and that they may have more of a Cold War, long-term deterrence, defense, you know, compellence and containment strategy.
What does such a reaction do inside the Trump White House?
Well, I think they realize that things are more difficult than the president claimed when he said that the North Korean problem is solved, that we can sleep peaceably at night, that denuclearization has already begun. You know, none of that is the case. So then you have the administration trying to figure out what to do, and there may be differences amongst those who are more amenable to a military option, saying, "Okay, we tried a diplomatic option, it didn't work. Let's go down the military path that they wanted." Others will say, "Okay, it's difficult, but it's worth continuing to try diplomacy." So we may have divisions within the administration, and then we're not quite sure which side the president will eventually come down on.
Klingner added that over the next several months, we will not see rising tensions. He says that we will have the U.S. and North Korea trying to save diplomacy. Further down the road, he says, we will have to see how the U.S. responds. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. After a meeting at the United Nations with his South Korean counterpart and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is calling on the international community to fully enforce sanctions against North Korea. Pompeo said the U.S. will need to see concrete actions from Pyongyang before the sanctions can be eased. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain had the story.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made a strong appeal to the international community to maintain pressure on North Korea until Kim Jong-un follows through on promises he made to President Donald Trump during the Singapore summit to start the process of fully verified denuclearization.
Strict enforcement of sanctions is critical to our achieving this goal. Members of the UN Security Council, and by extension all UN member states, have unanimously agreed to fully enforce sanctions on North Korea, and we expect them to continue to honor those commitments.
Pompeo and the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, warned that North Korea is trying to get around the sanctions, smuggling petroleum products into the country by sea at levels that exceed what is allowed under international sanctions.
The problem that we are encountering is that some of our friends have decided that they want to go around the rules. You saw that there was violations of the oil ban.
Some experts tell VOA that China has a very consistent but very bad record on imposing sanctions.
We do need, therefore, to also pressure China to maintain the sanctions that they have imposed, because those are the ones that are going to most meaningfully hurt North Korea and keep them at the table and keep them conforming to their own commitments.
On Thursday, Russia and China moved to block the U.S., putting a six-month hold on a request to ban further fuel shipments to Pyongyang. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
In Pakistan, nearly 106 million people cast their ballots in Wednesday's violence-marred general elections. Just hours after voting began, a powerful suicide blast outside a polling station in Quetta killed more than 31 people and wounded 40 others. The radical Islamic State took responsibility for plotting the carnage. Police say the victims included voters, police personnel, and political party activists. Reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad spoke Wednesday night with VOA's Sarah Williams about the election beginning with that outbreak of violence.
We witnessed this massive suicide bombing in Quetta, which is the provincial capital in Balochistan province. And it killed dozens of people. And then there were some separate clashes between activists of rival political parties, plus a convoy of polling staff was ambushed by militants in Balochistan again, and that also left four people dead, including Pakistani troops. So, yes, that was the area where we were expecting some violence, because that is where Islamic State has carried out massive bombing, and that province of Pakistan obviously borders Afghanistan, where Pakistani officials say Islamic State has its bases. But otherwise, overall, across Pakistan, the voting process was relatively peaceful. And, yeah, it was like a 10-hour day for the Election Commission has had designated for the voters, which has now, the process has now concluded and the counting has begun.
Now, this election contest, it seems like it's between the parties of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz and the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, or PTI, which is led by the internationally famous cricket star Imran Khan. Apparently, these are the two parties that are leading in the contention.
That's true. These are the parties, and that was where everybody was focusing on, because Imran Khan's party has obviously gained over the last years a lot of support, and it has emerged as a major challenge for former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's political party, which has strong bases in the Punjab province, which is the most populous province of Pakistan.
Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad. Now, there could be trouble ahead. Over the past few hours, the head of Pakistan's former ruling party has rejected the results of the parliamentary elections before the results are announced, claiming the vote was rigged. Shahbaz Sharif, who heads the Pakistan Muslim League party, said the results of Wednesday's vote were being tampered with. He did not provide any evidence or elaborate. His allegation came hours after the closing of polls Wednesday, although the country's elections oversight body was yet to announce even the first results of the elections. Who will be the next leader of Pakistan, and what will that mean to the United States and the rest of the world? That's what I asked Michael Kugelman. He's the deputy director of the Asia Program and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center.
I think that what's most likely, the most likely outcome is, a hung parliament, which basically means no one party wins an absolute majority, and that the party that does win the most votes needs to essentially form a power-sharing agreement and govern in a coalition. I think that's what we're most likely to see. Probably, if I had to put money on it, I would say that the PMLN would eke out a narrow victory, but it could certainly go the other way, too.
Imran Khan has made some statements that cannot be to the liking of the United States. When he has referred to Iran, it has been quite positive. When he has referred to the Taliban, sometimes it's been positive. How would an Imran Khan victory make its way as far as relationships between the United States and Pakistan?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, what would an Imran Khan victory mean for U.S.-Pakistan relations, which are already quite stressed at the moment? I think the context is important here. Plenty of Pakistani politicians say nasty things about the U.S. that plays well with public opinion, which tends to be pretty anti-American in Pakistan. Though it's true that Imran Khan does go a bit further. One thing that he's most famous or infamous for saying a few years ago is that if he were to be in power, he would give the order to shoot down American drones in Pakistan. I think that, quietly, they wouldn't admit this publicly, but I think quietly there are some, officials, U.S. government officials in Washington that would be a bit nervous and weary if Imran Khan were to take office. And he has some pretty senior advisors who have also been quite shrill and strident in their anti-American messaging. But this is the thing. Typically the army in Pakistan runs the show when it comes to policy toward the U.S. and the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. So, I think that on one level one could assume that if Imran Khan were to win, the army would still be controlling policy toward the U.S. And the U.S.-Pakistan relationship's in bad shape now. But it wouldn't necessarily get worse because Prime Minister Khan is in power. If the army is still calling the shots, it would be able to moderate his harsh rhetoric. But then again, going back to the personality issue, and I've written about this recently, that I don't necessarily see Imran Khan as someone who would be willing to give space to the army on policy toward the U.S., which has clearly been something that Khan feels very strongly about. He has a lot of ideas about how he thinks the relationship should be. So if he does push back against the army, I think that could raise the very likely possibility of a new era of political volatility rooted in a deepening of civil-military relations, which were, you know, very, very strained during the last government as well. So the bottom line is I don't necessarily think that the election and its various outcomes will have much of an impact on U.S.-Pakistan relations because the army runs the show no matter what. But, you know, if you have Khan in there and he starts trying to push back against the army and he starts trying to exert himself that way, that could be notable, but I'm not sure it would come to that.
Is Imran Khan a trusted person in Pakistan? Are there doubts about his ability to be the leader of the country?
Yeah, you know, I find Imran Khan is just truly one of the most fascinating figures in South Asia, in my view. You know, here's someone who is a national hero because of his cricket exploits. You know, 1992, he led Pakistan to a world championship in cricket. It was one of the biggest joys in the history of Pakistan. Even now, nothing has been like that. You know, he was revered. He was no one disliked him. Then he turned to politics, and I would argue he's now become maybe one of the most polarizing figures in Pakistan. There are plenty of people that love and trust him. I mean, he's got supporters that simply fawn over him. He has a cult of personality effect. But then there are plenty of others, particularly the more liberal Pakistanis, who feel that he's a complete disaster. They refer to him as Taliban Khan because of his, you know, the fact that he's always talked about the need to negotiate with terrorists, not fight them. They talk about, you know, the people that don't like him simply say that he's a disaster, that he's hypocritical, he's erratic, and there's no reason to trust him. And I don't know if there's a middle ground. So, you know, I think that given his personality, which again is rather mercurial and unpredictable, given the fact that neither he nor his party have ever held national power, I think there is a bit reason to be a bit weary if he and the party were to take over the government. But again, that's not to say that things wouldn't settle down. I mean, he does have a number of aides, high-level aides, that have been in the politics business for decades and have come from other parties. So I think that eventually things would stabilize, but at least initially, I do think that because of his personality and his lack of experience, people will be a bit concerned about what Imran Khan would bring to the table as a prime minister.
Michael Kugelman, the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. You may have heard China's aviation regulator suspended the licenses of the pilot and co-pilot of an Air China Boeing 737 that dropped more than 3,000 meters during a July 10th flight from Hong Kong to Dalian. The co-pilot, smoking an e-cigarette, mistakenly switched off the air conditioning, causing a sudden loss of depressurization and the deployment of oxygen masks. No injuries were reported. The Civil Aviation Administration of China also ordered a cut of 10% of the carrier's 737 flights for a 3-month safety review and fined the carrier the equivalent of $7,500. The Boeing aircraft account for about 40% of Air China's fleet. Jeffrey Chang is an aviation and shipping analyst with the Hong Kong-based Bank of Communications of China. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the CAAC action is having an impact on the airline's schedule.
They will have to cut 10% of the, B737 flights as well, equivalent to roughly about a cut of 5,400 hours of flight time for that particular class of aircraft.
Why are they cutting the aircraft when this was just a one-off incident involving one crew?
Well, it seems like the CAAC think that there is something the management should have prevented and things like that. So eventually that penalty is kind of creep up to the company level. But besides that, actually the co-pilot as well as the pilot, the license has been suspended. The one that actually light the smoke had actually been cancelled, and according to the press, that the reapplication will not be entertained by CAAC as well for that particular pilot.
Has anything like this happened before?
I haven't seen that. I've been covering the sector for almost like 10 years. No, as far as my memory goes, no, that hasn't happened before. But as you know, electric smoke is something quite brand new, right, these days.
What is Air China's safety record?
That's not bad. Actually, in the past 10 years, I haven't seen any major incidents, things like that.
What is this going to do to Air China's business?
Our estimate is kind of small because Air China actually has a fleet by the end of last year, roughly about 655 aircraft. they have around 269 aircraft of 737 series, and so it's roughly about one-third of that. 5,400 hours, according to our estimate, is roughly about 6% of the potential flight hours of that particular class of say aircraft per month for Air China. Similarly, as you know, they have also the Airbus, a similar class, similar size, like A320. They have around 200 of them. So what we are thinking is that, firstly, they probably will possibly redeploy some of the Airbus in place of the B737 in case of need. Secondly, as you know, for any airline and as well within their network, there must be some flights that probably will not make money. So it would be a good time for them to look at their network and say, hey, yeah, if we are cutting our, say, service hours, then what about we cut several flights as well? Because in any case, this flight would be making losses. So combining these customers with other flights and things like that will probably be positive to the company. So our estimate is that in terms of the capacity, things like that, it will probably be an impact less than 2% in a particular month.
The incident came at a bad time for Air China as airlines struggle with a falling yuan and rising fuel costs. Its shares fell over 1% in Hong Kong on Wednesday. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. For Rohingya refugees living in New Delhi, each day comes with a new set of challenges. A relief camp on a forbidden parcel of land in the eastern part of the Indian capital measures less than 100 square meters. The refugees there live in constant fear of eviction and the threat from both fire and water. VOA's Ritul Joshi took a look at the plight of these stateless refugees in New Delhi.
Even before one sets foot in this Rohingya camp in the Kalindi Kunj neighborhood of Delhi, a huge poster proclaims that refugees do not belong here. This land is the property of the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. Rohingya refugees like Kabir were forced to move here in April when a big fire destroyed their original relief camp.
There is nothing left but our lives. Everything I had earned in the past 6 years was burnt. Not even close.
Back then, the Rohingya refugees lived in tarpaulin tents on a piece of land owned by the Zakat Foundation, a Muslim non-profit organization. After the fire, the foundation started building tin and asbestos homes to house the refugees, only to learn later that about 110 meters of the planned camp was the property of Uttar Pradesh state. Construction remains suspended, pending legal determination of ownership.
The subdivisional magistrate requested us to let these people remain here until demarcation is done. On his request, we have put these people here, which is not easy from the point of view of construction. It also makes things difficult for the refugees.
The foundation pays about $146 per day to keep the tents here. It's a big financial burden for the organization and a danger for the refugees who live their lives amid exposed wires and plastic sheets, the main culprits causing the first fire. Despite the fire risks, Rohingyas say they are more worried about the coming monsoon rains.
When it rains, water enters our tents from all sides. All our belongings, including food, gets wet.
On humanitarian grounds, we want these people to live comfortably here. There are a lot of little children here. We don't want any harm coming to them.
For the almost 250 Rohingya refugees who live inside the disputed camp, harm remains a constant and daily companion, even as they wait for the elusive promise of shelter and security. Ritul Joshi for VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Scientists in Australia say they've developed the world's first blood test to detect melanoma in its early stages. It's hoped the technique will save hundreds of lives each year by identifying cancer cells before they spread. Phil Mercer reported from Sydney, where Australia and neighbouring New Zealand have the highest rates of skin cancer in the world.
Currently, skin examinations and biopsies are the most effective ways to detect melanoma. A blood test developed by university researchers in Western Australia could pick up the cancer much sooner, increasing a patient's chances of survival. The test recognises autoantibodies that are part of the body's natural defences against cancer. In a trial involving about 200 people, the technique detected the early stages of skin cancer in more than 80% of cases. Professor Mel Zeiman is the head of the Edith Cowan University Melanoma Research Group.
We're hoping that it will reduce the number of people that get metastatic disease, because that's where it becomes tricky. If a thin melanoma is identified early and it's removed, you have a 98 to 99% chance of 5 to 10 year survival. So that's what we're hoping to achieve, is that people will feel more comfortable going for skin checks. So it will just up the number of people that are aware and able to get their melanoma identified earlier.
Malignant melanoma is the most serious form of skin cancer. It's mainly caused by exposure to UV radiation. In Australia, about 1,500 people die from the disease each year. More clinical research on the new Australian blood test is planned in an attempt to improve its accuracy to 90%. The technique could be available within 5 years. Researchers have said the test won't pick up other types of skin cancers, such as squamous cell and basal cell carcinoma. Other health experts have said the results of the trial need to be interpreted with caution. They've urged people to keep checking their skin as a way to detect the early signs of skin cancer. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In or out of the sun, more women drivers are taking to the streets. Dozens of girls in Afghanistan's northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif lined up to take their driving test. They defied social norms that prohibit female driving by joining driving classes and trying to get their driver's licenses. Women's rights advocates say driving is a major part of independence from men. VOA's Mirwais Behzhan visited one training session and had this report narrated by Behzhan Hamdard.
Women are seen in the streets of Mazar-e-Sharif driving cars. It is unusual to see women driving in the city. In this driving test session, 50 girls showed up to complete a month-long class. These new drivers say driving is a step toward self-reliance and independence.
In my opinion, this is a great opportunity for women to learn how to drive. I think everyone should encourage women to drive instead of, God forbid, say bad things.
The problems that women face while driving, people often say negative things. They should support women more.
This is the first time women have gotten assistance from the local traffic administration, the Women Affairs Administration, and a private organization to finish their driving classes. Rukhsar Nuri got the support of her parents in learning to drive. That is rare in her hometown, where the conservative Afghan society frowns on female drivers.
We women often demand equality so that we can play a bigger role in our society. We say that we are half of the community, and in order to make that happen, we have to fight against taboos.
Women rights advocates say the taboo makes women dependent on men in their social life.
There are certainly problems that women can't comfortably go out and drive. One of the main issues is the existing of old traditions and taboos that have prevented women from driving.
Last year, 300 women received their driver's licenses to become first Afghan women drivers in northern Afghanistan. For Mirwais Behzhan in Mazar-e-Sharif, Afghanistan, this is Behzhan Hamdard, VOA News.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. Chinese President Xi Jinping was in the midst of his fourth trip to Africa, with stops in Senegal, Rwanda, South Africa, and the Indian Ocean island nation of Mauritius. Mr. Xi took part Wednesday at a summit of the so-called BRICS nations in Johannesburg, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. China has become Africa's largest trading partner. According to the China-Africa Research Initiative at Johns Hopkins University, Beijing, its banks and contractors have loaned more than $94 billion to African governments and state-owned companies from 2000 to 2015. Its only military base outside China is in the Horn of Africa country of Djibouti. David Shin is an American diplomat and adjunct professor of international affairs at George Washington University. He told VOA's Victor Beatty China's involvement in Africa has ramped up this century.
The trading ties, the Chinese foreign direct investment, Chinese security interests in Africa have grown phenomenally in the 21st century. They were fairly modest through the 1990s, and what we've seen is a very significant change.
This includes, of course, the so-called Belt and Road Initiative. That is having a big impact in many African countries.
It is and it isn't. I noticed, for example, that when Xi Jinping was in Senegal, he signed an agreement with Senegal to be part of the Belt and Road Initiative. China has done that with quite a variety of countries in Africa. that are far from the so-called Belt and Road. Senegal, for example, is nowhere near geographically the location of what we normally refer to as the Belt and Road. I think what is going on here with the Belt and Road is you're taking ongoing projects, some of which were agreed to even before the Belt and Road Initiative was even announced, and then you're incorporating them into the Belt and Road Initiative. So it's sort of a way to put a moniker over Chinese activity in the region, much of which would have happened anyway. But they're getting a lot of mileage out of this, and I think by and large the Africans are receptive to this approach.
Africa is loading up itself on Chinese debt?
One has to be careful with that. There is a fair amount of Chinese debt being accumulated by certain African countries, but there are 54 countries in Africa, and you have to take it country by country. For example, I was in Ghana last month, and in Ghana I was told that the percent of Chinese external debt that China holds is only 8%. That means 92% is held by a whole bunch of other countries or international organizations. On the other hand, if you look at a country like Djibouti, the percent of Djibouti's external debt held by China is probably right around 85-90%. So it's a very serious issue in a place like Djibouti. But if you try to generalize Chinese debt across the continent, you get into real difficulties very quickly, because in many cases, I don't think we really know what the percentage is.
What is China's big game in Africa? Of course, it has enormous investments. It has a military base in Djibouti. Is it seeking political support?
Among other things, absolutely, it's seeking political support. With 54 votes in the United Nations, it accounts for more than one quarter of all the membership of the UN General Assembly. Africa has voting rights in places like the World Trade Organization, all of the different agencies of the United Nations. So their votes count, and China pays attention to that, just like the United States does, and it does solicit their support. In addition, China is interested in access to raw materials coming out of Africa. It's interested in exporting more to Africa in order to earn foreign exchange. It's only about 5% of China's global market, but, you know, 5% is a lot more than it was 20 years ago when it was about 1%. So it's increasing even the percent of China's global trade. So they have a variety of interests in Africa.
Ambassador David Chin said most of China's activities in Africa are benign, although its security involvement bears watching. Mr. Xi also visited the United Arab Emirates this trip, and Ambassador Chin said it signified China's growing trade and investment interest and rising influence in all regions of the world. Some groups or individuals linked to terrorism are openly campaigning in Pakistan's general elections. They were scheduled for July 25th and did take place. Members of mainstream political parties were worried about the impact of these individuals if they get elected to parliament. VOA's Aisha Tanzim had the report from the Pakistan capital of Islamabad.
Hafiz Saeed, a man on both the UN and US terrorist lists, is welcomed warmly at an election rally in Islamabad. The election commission denied registration to his party, the Milli Muslim League, so it fielded candidates under another name, the Allahu Akbar movement. But candidates display Saeed's picture prominently on their banners, making their affiliation with him clear. His party is fielding more than 250 candidates for the national and provincial assemblies.
Our leaders decided in the last 5-6 months that we contest elections. We're getting a great response. People are tired of the old political parties. None of them have delivered anything for the common man.
Another banned sectarian group called ASWJ, which is linked with the killing of thousands of Shiite Muslims, is said to be fielding candidates under a new name as well. The name of the party's leader, Mohammad Ahmed Ludhianvi, was removed from a watch list last month, his assets unfrozen and travel restrictions removed. Pakistan's security institutions have been talking about mainstreaming these groups to tackle the challenge of violent extremism. But analysts say without a comprehensive plan of de-radicalization, allowing them into the political arena could be damaging for Pakistan.
So far, the impression that the whole world and we are getting is that there is no plan to rehabilitate or de-radicalize them. Rather, this seems to be a plan to expand their influence.
Members of Pakistan's mainstream political parties are also worried about the impact of these groups in politics. In a recent session, several senators warned the Election Commission against allowing their participation in the upcoming elections.
The Election Commission has sent notices to three candidates asking them to explain their links to banned groups, but their spokesman refused to comment on why others are allowed to campaign openly. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
One of the most contentious elections in Pakistan's history did indeed seemingly come to an end, with cricketer-turned-politician Imran Khan's party likely to form the next government. Speaking after declaring his victory, Khan called the elections free and fair despite the objections of rival parties.
It is one of the freest and fairest elections in Pakistan. The 2013 election, all the parties said it was rigged. 22 parties said the election was rigged. And I was the only one who said there should be an investigation. So 2018 election, this election should be free and fair. But all the parties opposed me because they all rigged the election.
As you hear, most other parties in the country complained of rigging. The election day was also marred by violence, but silver lining in the clouds emerged in the form of new firsts for minority and women voters. VOA's Aisha Tanzeem brought us a snapshot of the day from the capital of Islamabad.
Hours after polling started, a devastating suicide attack in Quetta, in southwestern Pakistan, killing more than 30 people. Islamic State takes responsibility. Security, a concern in other parts of the country too.
We can't see any security around here. The only security we see is inside the polling station, but nothing in the surrounding areas.
But the news is not all grim.
In other parts of the country, the atmosphere around polling stations, especially in big cities, is more festive. People have come with families to vote, and the children are hanging around as the adults are casting their ballots.
While reports emerge of men stopping women from voting in some constituencies, in others, history is made. In Dir, Kohistan, North and South Waziristan, women vote for the first time. Meanwhile, those lining up to cast their ballots complain of a slow process.
My wife has been standing in line for 2 hours, but the polling process is so slow. And they are wasting so much time that a lot of women are standing in queue. Everyone is upset.
Several political parties cite these delays as a reason to request extra polling time, but the Election Commission denied the request. As the voting ends and counting starts, several political parties complain that the final numbers are being manipulated. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
A group of Pakistani engineering students has developed a voice-operated wheelchair to help those disabled achieve more self-reliance. The chair is getting some traction, as we hear in this report from Saman Khan in Lahore, narrated by Behzad Hamdard.
They say necessity is the mother of invention, and this couldn't have been more true for Faiz Arbab.
When my grandmother fell in the bathroom and injured herself, I thought of how helpless she was and that she had to depend on others. So I thought to myself, what if there is a wheelchair that can make her independent?
Arbab is an engineering student at Lahore University of Management Sciences. He presented his idea to the National Incubation Center and then set about making it happen with the help of his team. They built a wheelchair named Gobi that understands voice commands.
Left. Vapas jao.
This is the first voice-operated wheelchair in the world. This is the smart wheelchair. It has a range of 100 feet.
A patient in bed needs someone to bring the wheelchair to them, even if the wheelchair is an electric one. This eliminates being dependent on anyone.
Gobi currently costs around $800, but Arbab is hoping the cost will go down.
Slowly but surely, we are hoping that the price will drop once we start mass producing.
Gobi comes with an app and can also be operated using a smartphone. The state-of-the-art wheelchair was launched in the market in June, and other companies have already showed interest in its technology.
We are also receiving phone calls from China and Japan to sell this technology. We are hoping to get assistance and support from our government to help us get these wheelchairs to our customers.
Faiz Arbab says this project will not end with this wheelchair. Next, he'll turn his attention to making his entire country disabled-friendly. For Saman Khan in Lahore, Pakistan, this is Behzad Hamdard, VOA News.
For years, denim jeans have been finished in foreign factories where workers use manual and automated techniques such as scraping and sandpaper or other abrasives to make the jeans appear worn and more comfortable to wear. However, things are changing in the fashion world. As VOA's Mariama Diallo reports, fashion companies are going digital to speed up the design and manufacturing process.
Designers at Levi Strauss are creating new finishes for jeans by using digital pens and touchscreen computers. The new designs are uploaded to a laser machine, and in just 90 seconds, a new pair of jeans is transformed. The process used to take 30 minutes by hand. It's a radical breakthrough, says Bart Seitz, vice president of technical innovation at the company.
It's one that will surely transform how jeanswear is designed and developed, how it's manufactured, and how it's sold.
By using this new digital platform, the 165-year-old retailer can significantly reduce the time it takes to bring the jeans from the factory to the consumer, says Liz O'Neill.
We can get our products in front of the consumer at the right time, and we can much more accurately predict what our consumers are going to want to see in our stores.
Global sourcing giant Lian Feng is helping its clients transition to a digital supply chain by showing them how new software and 3D rendering can make clothing manufacture more efficient.
So if you think about creating product in 3D, where you could actually essentially create an entire collection before you even cut one garment. So it reduces waste, it reduces lead times, it allows decision making in real time.
Chris Lindland, the CEO of the San Francisco fashion firm Beta Brand, agrees.
The amount of time that goes on decision-making and making prototypes can take weeks and months, and we eliminate that.
The new wave of technologies is already transforming the fashion industry as the pace and the demand for newer, more innovative designs and products speeds up. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. Access to clean and drinkable water is challenging for residents in Lahore because the tap water in many parts of the Pakistani city is polluted. A team of engineering students is working hard to create an affordable filtration system so every home can have safe water. VOA's Saman Khan visited their lab and filed this report, narrated by Miguel Amaya.
Experts say that Pakistan will face severe water shortages by the year 2025. Those who live in Lahore are already experiencing the sum of its effects. Water supply problems are common in big cities like Lahore, where pollution in some areas forces people to go to water filtration plants.
Sometimes I go 4 or 5 kilometers away from home for filtered water in hopes that I can find an open filtered water pump.
Ali Manan Tirmizi is studying electrical engineering in Lahore University of Management Sciences. With the help of his team, Tirmizi is working on creating an inexpensive filtration device anyone can use at home.
We have made a very low-cost and effective filter, which is very easy to use. The current system we are working on removes bacteria very well, and we are also trying to make it able to block viruses in the water as well.
Many poor neighborhoods are not reached by safe water supplies, so we're working on a decentralized system that anyone can use to make the water at home drinkable.
Pine tree branches are used in the filter unit.
We need decent-sized branches that have enough xylem vessel bundles. We cut that into 2 to 3 centimeter pieces and place it in a boiling water with a chemical overnight. This becomes the base of our filter, and we continue working from there.
As the water shortage problem gets more severe in Pakistan, this student-developed filter will become more important. For Salman Khan in Lahore, Pakistan, this is Miguel Amaya, VOA News.
Troubles for vaccines and soybeans in China were explained by Skylar Ogden in last week's VOA's Asia Business Scene.
China's drug industry is in trouble as yet another scandal hits it. This time, the scandal involves a rabies vaccine made by one of the country's biggest pharmaceutical companies, Changzhou Changxian Biotechnology. Regulators halted production of the rabies vaccine made by the company after finding fabricated records and other problems during an inspection. The news sent stocks tumbling. Shares of Changzhou Changxian's parent company fell by the 10% limit. Other drug companies were also affected. Vaccine suppliers Shenzhen Kangtai Biological Products and Walvax Biotechnology also dropped by its 10% daily allowable limit. This is the third crisis involving vaccines since 2010. Most recently, regulators found diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccines made by Changzhou Changxian were substandard. Authorities in Hebei also accused another firm, Wuhan Institute of Biological Products, of making those same ineffective vaccines. The scandals have created a crisis of confidence in an industry which made more than $3 billion in revenue last year. Many parents say they simply won't buy Chinese-made vaccines anymore because they don't trust officials to clean up the industry. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang has vowed stern action over the latest safety scare. Soybean importers in China are quickly adapting to the new tariffs on U.S. soybeans, looking for alternative markets and switching to other substitutes whenever possible. At Hopeful Grain and Oil Group, one of China's leading agricultural companies, U.S. soybeans used to be a mainstay, but farmers switched to Brazilian soybeans just weeks before July 6th. That's the date the U.S. levied tariffs on $34 billion worth of Chinese imports, sparking immediate retaliation from Beijing. In China's central province of Hunan, farmers are reducing their use of soybean pulp meal, which is typically used as a main ingredient in animal feed. Analysts say they don't see a lot of damage being caused by the tariff war in the short run, but the long term could look differently for China. Xu Bin is a professor of economics and finance at the China-Europe International Business School.
In the short run, I think the negative effects are in a sense, limited. But I worry more about the long term because now the all countries are integrated. And so if you just damage the integration, then that is going to be long-lasting because if factories shift out of China to other countries, then it is difficult to shift back.
The U.S. relies heavily on the Chinese market for soybean sales. Last year, 31% of U.S. soybean production was exported to China. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
Scientists studying the effects of the potentially game-changing gene editing pool, CRISPR-Cas9, have found it can cause an unexpected genetic damage, which could lead to dangerous changes in some cells. VOA's Faith Lapidus has more on that development.
Scientists studying the gene editing tool CRISPR-Cas9 have found a problem. The technology, which promises to revolutionize the way we treat certain diseases, such as HIV and cancer, may not be as benign as previously thought. The technique uses ribonucleic acid molecules to guide the Cas9 protein to a defective part of a genome, where it acts like molecular scissors cutting out a specific part of the DNA, replacing it with a corrective segment. But Alan Bradley, at Britain's Wellcome Sanger Institute, says it may also inadvertently lead to DNA mutations far from the repaired site.
If you're going to use this in a clinical context where you're editing billions and billions of cells in a human, then the chances are that hundreds of millions of those cells will suffer a type of damage that you didn't know before. And the potential of those cells to then become cancerous or to have some other problem is probably quite significant.
The researchers warned that some of the mutations seen in their study were too far from the target site to be picked up with standard analysis and testing methods.
This is very much a point of you find what you look for, you don't find what you don't look for. So far, the assays have really focused on a few hundred base pairs of the DNA around the target site, so where the cut is taking place. But it ignores the 3 billion bases of the rest of the genome.
Bradley says knowing where to look for these changes can make scientists more secure in their assessment of the safety of CRISPR technology and could spark renewed interest in developing other alternatives for gene editing. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
President Donald Trump has praised recent satellite images that indicate North Korea appears to have begun the process of dismantling some key facilities at the Sohae Satellite Launching Station on the country's northwest coast. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said such activities would be consistent with the commitment North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made to Trump in Singapore. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department.
North Korea's nuclear threat was one of the topics on the agenda when Secretary Pompeo and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis met with their Australian counterparts in California. Satellite images taken of the launching facility in June and then 1 month later in July appear to show dismantling activity. Pompeo had a cautious response.
We've been pressing for there to be inspectors on the ground when that engine test facility is dismantled, consistent with Chairman Kim's commitment, and I'll leave it at that for this morning.
Asked what further steps North Korea needs to take, Pompeo had this reply.
That's easy. They need to completely, fully denuclearize. That's the steps that Chairman Kim committed to and that the world has demanded through UN Security Council resolutions. It's that straightforward.
On Capitol Hill, some lawmakers were also cautiously optimistic.
This is the first sign that there may be some movement by the North Korean regime in the direction of meeting the commitments that were made. It would be more encouraging to me if we saw the return of the remains of Americans killed in action during the Korean War. It would be even more encouraging if there were some detailed plan discussed about how irreversible and verifiable denuclearization might happen. But this is an encouraging first step.
After their summit in June, Trump said Kim had promised him that a major missile engine testing site would be destroyed soon. But their agreement contained no details about when or how North Korea would abandon its nuclear weapons program or shut down its existing nuclear facilities. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
We continue now. As all five species of rhino in Africa and Asia are endangered or face extinction, an Australian-based professor and conservationist suggests that Australia might be a good place for some rhinos to be protected and rebuild their numbers within the confines of cattle stations or other enclosed areas. Bill Lawrence is a distinguished professor at the James Cook University in Cairns. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beattie about efforts by European scientists who recently created hybrid embryos from sperm of the last deceased northern white rhino in the laboratory.
This is really getting down to sort of Jurassic Park type desperation, but the last male of the northern white rhino died in March, so there's two females left. So they're using frozen sperm and harvested eggs, and they've created essentially embryos in test tubes. And now what they're going to do is actually try to implant those in a southern white rhino female. So you're going to kind of have a little bit of a hybrid offspring, and that it'll be genetically a northern white rhino, but it'll be born to a southern white rhino mother. It's not an ideal situation, but this, as they say, desperate times call for desperate measures, and this is really getting down to extremely difficult situation.
Well, when we talk about rhinos in general, there are a number of subspecies, but the animal itself is endangered, isn't it?
Yeah, there's five species of rhinos, and they're all pretty much in bad shape. The one that's in the best shape of all is the southern white rhino, but it was knocked down to a century ago. There were only 20 individuals of it alive at all, and it's made an amazing comeback to about 20,000 today. For the other four species of rhinos, so two of those are in Africa and the other three are in Asia, they're all desperately endangered. For instance, the Javan rhino, there's only about 60 of those left, and they live in just a little tiny area out in western Java. The Sumatran rhino, all biologists will say, and we work in Sumatra, is that it persists in a few little pockets there, but we don't say where because we don't want poachers to get in there and wipe out those last individuals.
Poaching, how big a problem is it?
It's an enormous problem. It's a combination of things because the rhino's habitat is being, you know, destroyed and shredded and chopped up, especially by this huge expansion of roads that we're seeing happening all over the world. In particular, China is driving initiatives to expand roads all through the Asia-Pacific region and in Africa and Latin America and in Africa and in Asia. That, of course, is oftentimes putting roads right into some of the last wild places where rhinos survive. And that lets the poachers in, and then we've got poachers with automatic weapons coming in, and they're just gunning down the rhinos. And unfortunately, rhinos are, you know, they're big, they're kind of nearsighted, they're fairly predictable in their habits, so they're easy to shoot. Sadly, what the poachers do is just machine gun the rhinos, and then they chop off the horn and they leave the animal to rot. They don't use the skin, they don't use the meat or anything like that. It's just removing the horn, which can be worth thousands to even tens of thousands of dollars.
Now, you're part of a process of possibly letting rhinos run free in Australia. What's behind this?
The thing about Australia is we're seeing rhinos being wiped out of mostly developing nations with rapidly growing populations and relatively limited rule of law and lots of weapons. Well, Australia has large expanses of tropical and subtropical savannas and woodlands and rainforests, which is the kinds of environments where these rhinos live. And it turns out rhinos are not especially picky about what they eat. And pretty good rule of law, and Australia doesn't have firearms. It's much more limited and controlled here. So you can't really imagine that kind of poaching problem happening here.
Bill Lawrence said enormous bureaucratic obstacles would have to be overcome to introduce rhinos into Australia, and many countries would justifiably be reluctant to give up their rhino populations. However, he said as the situation becomes more desperate, it may be considered a serious option. Lawrence said he has received support from within the scientific community for this proposal as a way to breed up rhinos and other endangered wildlife so that they might one day be reintroduced back into their native habitats. Scientists announced Wednesday that they had discovered what appears to be a body of salty liquid water beneath the surface of Mars, raising the possibility of detecting life on the red planet. The reservoir, spanning about 20 kilometers in diameter under ice on the planet's southern pole, was found through a radar instrument on the Mars Express orbiter, which was launched in 2003. Researchers previously discovered signs that water did once flow on Mars. It's tempting to think that this is the first candidate place where life could persist on Mars, said Alberto Orose, a professor with the Italian National Institute for Astrophysics. He led the research published in the journal Science. He also said Mars may contain hidden bodies of water that have yet to be discovered. Orose said the size of the reservoir really qualifies this as a body of water. It's like a lake and not like some kind of meltwater filling someplace between rock and ice, he said. The scientists say the discovery gives them a roadmap to potentially finding life under the surface. Mars is cold, barren, and dry, but used to be warm and wet. The researchers say the water in the lake might have been kept from freezing due to a high concentration of salt. One scientist who was not involved in the study said microorganisms have been able to survive in similar conditions on Earth. In a new warning, the UN's World Meteorological Organization says the world is becoming increasingly vulnerable to the impact of climate change. It says this phenomenon is due to many factors and is not occurring at the same rate or degree around the globe. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WMO headquarters in Geneva.
Parts of the world are feeling the strain of record-breaking heat waves, drought, devastating floods, and raging wildfires. They are having a widespread impact on human health, agriculture, ecosystems, and infrastructure. The World Meteorological Organization reports climate change is influencing this trend in varying degrees. The chief of the WMO's World Weather Research Program, Paolo Ruti, says there is no discernible global pattern of climate change, but its impact is increasingly visible in certain areas, such as the Arctic.
We have seen wildfires in the Arctic, so there is a favoring conditions related to the fact that climate change is acting, so you are melting the permafrost, you have much more that vegetation that is available. You have sometimes you have stronger winds, so you have several factors.
Another interesting factor, he says, is a discernible increase in storms and lightning events, which also can trigger fires in the Arctic. He tells VOA that climate change in some places is happening faster than previously predicted.
It depends on what is your target, because if it is the Arctic, the answer is yes. So you see an acceleration of the melting in the recent 5-6 years.
WMO scientist Ruti notes this question needs to be put into context. He says what is happening in the Arctic regarding climate change would not apply to other global events such as sand or dust storms. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you for sharing some of your valuable time with us on VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are invited to join us again next week, as well as keeping in touch throughout the week by checking in to voanews.com.